take the risks. And I hope
you really see this.
I've got my fingers crossed for Rouhani supporters. I'm Susan, so hang on. Excited by this.
There's a lot to, and of course we have this massive turmoil in the U.S., which definitely draws a line under the fact that you Americans basically are looking out for American interests wherever and whenever they happen to touch down. So it's a shame that more energy and effort is not devoted to getting along with the rest of the world. This has been Ekaskadia for Monday, September 30th, 2013. We have Joe Clement engineering for us today. Thanks so much, Joe. Kathleen Stevenson's the KBOO AM News and Public Affairs Director. I'm Chris Andre. Get the facts. Know your rights. Take a stand. Thanks for listening and stay tuned.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Wilkin & Company, PC, Certified Public Accountants, helping businesses, individuals, and nonprofit organizations make financial decisions based on their personal values since 1987. Wilkin & Company is located at 2435 Southwest 5th Avenue in Portland. Information at 503-225-1359 or wilkincpas.com.
Prison Pipeline is a radio program dedicated to educating the public about the Oregon criminal justice system. Topics include incarceration and reentry, addictions and mental health, elections and laws, victims' rights, and criminal justice reform. The program presents a unique understanding of the criminal justice system, addresses the root causes of crime, and challenges the status quo. It seeks to promote awareness and activism in order to foster a safer, healthier, and more just society.
Prison Pipeline airs on Monday evenings from 6:30 to 7 p.m. on KBOO Portland. Check us out every week. If you miss an episode, you can stream it later. Just go to kboo.fm/prisonpipeline. More info about upcoming shows and events related to the prison community can be found on our Facebook page, Prison Pipeline. Be sure to like us.
Good morning and welcome to Locus Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, your host for this weekly conversation about our place on the planet. The rapid spread of hydraulic fracturing, or fracking as it's known, has temporarily boosted U.S. natural gas and oil production and driven down energy costs. But it's also sparked a massive environmental backlash in communities across the country where the impacts of fracking are being felt. This morning we talk with Richard Heimberg, whose new book, Snake Oil, How Fracking's False Promise of Plenty Imperils Our Future, casts a critical eye on the oil industry hype around fracking that has hijacked America's energy conversations. Richard is the author of numerous books and is a senior fellow at the Post-Carbon Institute. Richard, welcome back to Locus Focus.
It's good to be speaking with you again, Barbara.
Well, this book is very timely, and actually one of the things that jumped into my mind as a conversation we should have is a lot of concern about those oil and gas spills in Colorado as a result of the floods. So we'll get there, but I think we probably should start by talking about what happened in the last few years to make natural gas so inexpensive, because I remember it wasn't that long ago that our natural gas prices were soaring, and we were told that we were at the end of petroleum in this country, and gasoline prices were going to go up and up. And all of a sudden, natural gas prices plummeted. The price of gasoline has kind of stabilized, if not gone down. What happened to make such a change in like the last 5 or 6 years?
Right. Well, the high prices created an incentive for a lot of small companies that were willing to take on the risk to invest in producing from low-grade reservoirs. Now, we're talking about generally tight reservoirs. These are terms from the industry.
So what does tight reservoir mean?
Yeah, rocks that are that have very low permeability. In other words, geologists have known for decades that the oil and gas was there, but it's in rock that that just doesn't want to give up the oil or gas. So you drill a conventional vertical well into it's usually shale, but not always, into one of these, let's say, shale reservoirs. And you get an immediate little burst of production, and then it just trails off really quickly because the oil and gas just doesn't want to move toward the wellbore. Okay, so what they did was to bring together a suite of technologies like horizontal drilling. So instead of drilling vertically into the fuel bearing formation, they're drilling laterally, drilling down maybe a kilometer, and then angling the drill bit so it drills out horizontally for another kilometer, directly into the oil or gas bearing layer. So this increases the contact between the fuel bearing layer and the wellbore. Then hydrofracturing, pumping in millions of gallons of water at very high pressure to enhance some of the natural fractures in the rock so that the oil or gas will flow out more easily, using chemicals, slickening agents, proppants, sand to prop open the cracks once they've been made. All of this is expensive, and it's risky. But it does make some of these marginal plays viable economically, at least as long as oil and gas prices remain high.
Actually, as we're going, I'm going to have you keep defining terms. Play is a word you used a lot in your book, and it took me a little while to figure out what it meant. So what do you mean by an oil and gas play?
It's basically a geological formation that has a certain geographic extent. For example, the Marcellus play is a very large, mostly shale gas play that underlies most of Pennsylvania, much of West Virginia, and New York State. Now these plays are highly variable in terms of, you know, some of them are better than others, but also within, let's say, the Marcellus, there are small areas that are highly productive and profitable to drill in, but then you get outside of those small areas, and initial production rates are much lower, and production declines very rapidly.
Well, we've heard an awful lot in the last several years. I think actually since Josh Fox came up with his film Gasland, fracking has become a common household term. And there's been, I think, a fair amount of publicity about how controversial it is. But let's talk about some of the way that fracking is presented to the public as being largely benign and beneficial, and the contradictions that you see in what you call the oil industry hype.
Right. Well, the small companies that have invested heavily in shale production have an enormous vested interest in the public's taking a benign view of this. And so they've hyped the potential production mercilessly, saying that we have 100 years or in some cases even 200 years of natural gas in these shale plays, that U.S. oil production from places like North Dakota and South Texas is going to continue growing for many years to come, so that the U.S. will be a bigger oil producer than Saudi Arabia. These kinds of claims don't really rest on good data, but they do wonders for raising the share price, the stock values of these little companies. And they depend upon that kind of hype for doing business. They have to raise lots of money in order to be able to afford to drill, because, again, these are very costly wells to drill, up to $10 million apiece, and we're talking about tens of thousands of these wells. So they've needed to raise, just over the past few years, hundreds of billions of dollars in investment capital. And the way to do that was to hype the potential. Now, it's not all hype. We have seen increasing natural gas production in the U.S. U.S. natural gas production is at its highest point in history right now. And U.S. oil production has increased pretty dramatically in the last couple of years. And previous to that, U.S. Oil production had been in decline since about 1970. So the industry has accomplished something here. We have to be clear about that. But the question is, are these claims really sound, or are they mostly just a way of hyping up share values? And my claim in the book is that it's mostly the latter, and that claim is based on a report that we did at Post Carbon Institute, a pretty thorough study of the data, which I'm happy to talk about in more detail.
Well, there's let's talk about what are some of the differences in the viewpoints between what you have in your report and what the promises that are being made by the oil and gas industry, as it would appear to, let's say, the common everyday citizen, that there's a lot of natural gas and there's a lot of gasoline now in the United States, and our energy resources seem to be almost infinite again, just like they appeared to be earlier in the 20th century, and so everything is great. So how would you counter that?
Right. Well, the claims are based largely on taking the initial results from the sweet spots or the core areas within each of the plays and then extrapolating them to the whole play. So let's take an example, the Barnett Shale in central Texas around Fort Worth. It was the first area where shale gas was produced using horizontal drilling and hydrofracturing. Okay, the claims for Barnett were that it would be producing for decades. And what's actually happened was that the core areas were drilled out first. They went after the best resources first, the low-hanging fruit. And those were drilled out. Now the Barnett is in decline, and production from the Barnett Shale has been dropping like a stone for the past couple of years, because the drillers have been forced out to the periphery of the play, where again initial production rates are much lower and decline in production is much more rapid in each well. So this is happening in each and every one of the plays where shale gas and tight oil are being produced. The Marcellus in Pennsylvania is the only one of the shale gas plays that's still seeing increasing production. In the oil plays, the Bakken in North Dakota and the Eagle Ford in South Texas are still seeing increasing production, but the increases are starting to taper off. And if you do the math on the number of possible drilling places in the sweet spots and the likely declines in the more peripheral areas, production from the Bakken and Eagle Ford is likely to top out and begin declining before 2017. So these are really flashes in the pan. These are bubbles, and unfortunately, the American people have been told, even by President Obama, that this is a long-range energy bonanza, that the U.S. can look forward to lots of oil and gas for decades to come. And therefore, in effect, we don't have to worry about investing in renewable energy sources or energy conservation or anything like that. And as a result of that, we really have very bad energy policy, and we're boxing ourselves into a corner.
Well, despite what you're saying, that this is a momentary blip, it does appear to the average consumer right now that there's an awful lot of natural gas available just by the price it costs to heat your home. And I remember it was like probably 10 years ago, our natural gas bill doubled from the year before,
right.
and then it halved a few years ago.
Yes.
So how do you get beyond the appearance that there's such an abundance of gas? I mean, because it's even affecting the markets, it's even affecting, or how is it affecting the ability for new exploration of fracking wells when the return that they're going to be able to get from these wells can't be that great since the price of gas has dropped?
Right. Well, what happened was the industry, and here again, we're not talking about the big companies like ExxonMobil and Chevron and so on. We're talking about smaller companies like Chesapeake, Devon, XTO, Range, Anadarko, dozens of them. They were competing with each other in the early days to purchase drilling leases. So they would go into towns all around Texas and Oklahoma, Arkansas, and then Pennsylvania, North Dakota, and knock on doors. This was all portrayed in the movie Promised Land by Matt Damon. Knocking on doors, buying up the rights to drill on people's property. And they were all, again, in competition with each other. And these drilling leases carried the provision, as all drilling leases do, that the company has to drill within a certain amount of time or else the lease ceases to be valid. Okay, so millions of acres were leased so rapidly that the companies then were more or less forced to drill faster than was actually in their economic interest. And producing a lot of natural gas also made them look better on Wall Street. So they looked like better investment if the company was producing more gas, then it looked like a better investment. So these companies ended up overproducing natural gas, and they drove the price down. It was up in the range of $12 a thousand cubic feet back in 2005. The price of natural gas was just soaring because regular conventional natural gas in the U.S. is depleting rapidly. Okay, so they bring on this unconventional gas from shale, the fracking gas. And they bring it on so fast that they drop the price down to $2 a thousand cubic feet. And at that price, nobody's making money. All of these companies are actually losing money on production. So how have they stayed in business the last few years? By selling off leases. And again, this requires hyping the value of the lease. It requires saying, oh, there's enormous amounts of gas that can be produced from these areas, and so this is such a bargain. So they sold leases to some of the big companies like Shell. They sold leases to foreign companies, ones in China, for example. And so companies like Chesapeake, for example, were making more money. Well, actually, they were only making money from lease sales. When it came to actually selling natural gas, they were actually losing money on every cubic foot they sold. So now that foot is about to drop, shoe is about to drop, because the companies that bought these leases are starting to realize that they overpaid. Shell, for example, just about a month ago, wrote down the value of its assets by $2 billion based on leases that it had purchased to the Eagle Ford play in South Texas. And now Shell is selling off those leases at a loss. The same thing is happening with company after company. The bubble is starting to burst, and in fact, in many ways, what's been going on in fracking land is another Wall Street bubble, sort of like the real estate bubble of a few years ago or the dot-com bubble a few years before that.
Well, we're talking this morning with Richard Heimberg, who is author of Snake Oil, How Fracking's False Promise of Plenty Imperils Our Future. If you're just tuning in, and we're talking this morning about the dangers of fracking and how it's been given a whole lot of a large hype promotion by not just the oil and gas industry, but also the U.S. government. I want to shift gears a little bit. I want to talk about wildlife habitat and public schools. And the two things come together in my mind. I just saw an article before I came to the station this morning about how there's a new study that's come out that's demonstrating that wildlife habitat in western Pennsylvania is being severely fractured by fracking. And it's really destructive for besides the wildlife that lives there, just for the entire ecosystem of the region. But I also was thinking a little while ago about the first report I ever heard about fracking, and I didn't know that that's what it was then, but I was hearing a report a number of years ago about this community in Fort Worth, Texas, that was having some problems with pollutants coming from natural gas drilling that was happening in this residential neighborhood, and some of the the wells were like right near a public school. So let's talk a little bit about how, well, as Sandra Steingruber calls it, like fracking is like everywhere. It turns everybody's backyard into an oil well or a resource extraction operation. So let's talk about how that both impacts our urban communities and residential communities across the country, as well as wildlife habitat.
Right. Well, we're not talking about just a few wells here. We're talking about tens of thousands. And why so many? Well, because actually each well is producing a relatively small amount of oil or gas. And the decline rates for these shale wells are typically very high, much higher than with conventional oil or gas wells. So if you drill a well in January, let's say, by December of the same year, production from that well will probably already have fallen 60% or more. So that means you have to drill another well in order to keep your production rate up. So these companies are on a production treadmill where they have to drill and drill and drill. And again, they've leased millions of acres of land. So that means that when they come into a community, the number of wells that they're likely to drill is very high. And unless there's a local ordinance to prevent it, they're likely to be drilling next to schools and hospitals and nursing homes and, you know, you name it. As a result, air quality is a big problem in communities where fracking is occurring, as well as water quality. It impacts public health. The stories about people with headaches and nosebleeds and, you know, other kinds of chronic health problems who live near fracking, the stories are legion, and they would be far more prominent were it not for the fact that the companies who are fracking will typically, when they encounter people who are having health problems or problems with their drinking water, the companies will make a settlement, and they will pay out so much money in return for which they always demand a non-disclosure agreement, so that if you have health problems as a result of fracking, you know, and typically these are poor communities. They like to go into poor communities because they get a lot more public support there, because the people desperately need the money for leases and jobs with fracking or support jobs or whatever. So they're going to have a tendency to turn a blind eye to the environmental impacts anyway. But then when, you know, if there's a problem and there's a settlement, well, they're going to take that settlement, even if it means shutting up and not telling another person, even their own doctor, about why they're suffering these health problems.
So what happens to the wells once they are no longer productive? Because I've also read articles, particularly ProPublica has done a series about all the injection wells all over the country, and I understand those injection wells are where they inject the chemical and effluents that come as the waste from the fracking operations. So what's the landscape left like after a series of wells are opened, run dry, and then capped?
Right. Well, of course, there's the landscape has changed as a result. You know, each of these well pads requires clearing, usually a football field sized area initially. Now, later on, that can be reclaimed somewhat, but of course, you know, it's never going to be the way it was. And then what happens with abandoned wells? That's a really good question. Yes, as they are capped, but what happens over time? Does the well casing just stay there and keep the remaining oil or gas from ever reaching the water table? Well casings fail even during the period when the well is in service a certain percentage of the time. Over longer periods of time, virtually all well casings are going to fail, if we're talking decades and centuries. So in a sense, these are kind of toxic time bombs waiting to go off. Now, you spoke about injection wells. Those are used to deal with the wastewater from the fracturing process. Now, you know, the hydrofracturing entails pumping 3-4 million gallons of chemical-laced water underground at high pressure. What do you do with the water afterward? That water has to be taken back up before oil and gas production can begin. So do you put it in a containment pond? Do you try to send it off to the local water treatment plant? Those are both very problematic from an environmental perspective. So what the industry has done in order to be more environmentally sound is to re-inject that wastewater deep underground in either old oil or gas wells or new wells dug just for this purpose. Injection wells have been shown to cause small earthquakes, which, you know, may not be that much of a problem in a place like Oklahoma, which has seen its worst earthquakes in history as a result of fracturing. But, of course, it's a much bigger problem in a place like California that has natural seismicity. But also in places where there's just not that much available fresh water anyway, places in drought conditions or where that are just naturally water challenged, like Colorado or California or many parts of Texas, there's really no good solution here, because the industry is basically taking fresh water out of rivers, streams, and wells and polluting it, and then, in the best instance, just burying that water deep underground, taking it out of the hydrological cycle. So either the wastewater is an above-ground pollutant, or it's a matter of just taking water out of the hydrological cycle and burying it. One way or the other, this is a very bad practice in terms of water safety.
Well, it seems still that the oil and gas industry touts fracking as a way to minimize the footprint of their resource extraction. And I was recently up in Calgary talking with some oil industry representatives who are involved with the tar sands operations in northern Alberta. And what they do, and they're touting the SAGD process, the in-situ mining of bitumen, that is where the direction that most tar sands operations are going now. And they're touting that as being far less environmentally destructive than the open pit mining that they've been doing before. So it makes me think, well, if you're going to compare fracking and in-situ mining to open pit mining, where take out areas that are, you know, unfathomable to even imagine, if that's our point of reference, how do we change the conversation so we're no longer comparing the kinds of impacts on the landscape that fracking have to open pit mining, and find some other measuring stick to compare it to that which might show just how serious an impact even fracking has?
Right. Well, you know, people who live near fracking often don't have to be convinced. They see the impact on the landscape. They can smell the bad air, and their lives are disrupted. The bright lights at night, noise, truck traffic. Typically, a single well will require something like 2,000 truck trips, big 18-wheel trucks, to bring in equipment and water and chemicals and the drill rig and so on. All of this adds up. If you're talking about hundreds of wells in a given small area, and this has provoked all kinds of backlash. Hundreds of citizen groups have formed, anti-fracking citizen groups, over the last few years, and this is not the big environmental organizations. In fact, some of the big environmental organizations, at least initially, supported fracking because they thought natural gas would be so much better for climate than burning coal, so therefore fracking would be justified. But the folks on the ground don't feel that way. And so these hundreds of grassroots organizations have formed, and they've been successful in many instances in pushing through either total bans on fracking within communities or steeper regulations. Take the town of Longmont, Colorado, for example. 60% of the population of Longmont voted to ban fracking altogether within city limits. Now, Of course, the oil and gas industry lobbied very, very heavily, spent a lot of money to keep fracking legal within Longmont, but they failed. And in fact, the state of Colorado is suing Longmont to rescind this ban. So the anti-fracking frenzy is really very much grassroots, and it's irrepressible because, again, people see it in front of their eyes, and they see it all over the place.
Well, this morning we're talking with Richard Heimberg, who's author of Snake Oil, How Fracking's False Promise of Plenty Imperils Our Future. And we're talking about peeling beneath the hype of the oil and gas industry as far as the benefits that they have been touting for fracking for quite a while. Now, let's talk some more about Colorado, because there's been a lot of concern about the oil and gas spills as a result of the massive flooding throughout the state a couple weeks ago. And what concerns does that raise for you? First of all, where the oil fields that are being impacted, and how are they being impacted by flooding?
Right. Well, the Niobrara play is underlies much of Colorado. So there is both oil and gas drilling. And both hydrofracturing and horizontal drilling, and also conventional production in Colorado. Colorado was an oil and gas producing state before fracking ever came along. So there's very large potential for environmental problems as a result of the flooding. There are large containment tanks that hold chemicals for fracking. There are large containment ponds holding wastewater from fracking that have been breached as a result of the floods. And we don't know all of the chemicals that have likely been unleashed. And that's, of course, partly because fracking chemicals are company secrets. And we have Dick Cheney to thank for that back in 2005 with the Cheney loophole that was added to a completely unrelated piece of legislation to enable the oil and gas industry to keep their chemicals secret. So we know that some of the chemicals used in hydrofracturing are cancer-causing chemicals like benzol, or toxic chemicals like formic acid. We don't know how much of which chemicals were in storage in Colorado, and we don't know yet how severe the damage was. But it's already pretty clear that there is a huge toxic waste cleanup crisis on our hands here, and it's not being reported to the general public.
Well, finally, how does this big oil and gas rush as a result of fracking, what kind of impact is it having on the conversations and the actual R&D for moving towards renewable energy sources in the coming future, and really seriously curtailing our carbon footprint?
Right. Well, this is really getting to the whole point of why I wrote the book Snake Oil. Snake oil, by the title, doesn't refer to oil and gas per se. It refers to the hype about our future energy potential with fracking. Because what's happened is the industry has captured the conversation about energy in the United States. Just a few years ago, that conversation was about how we needed to get off, especially oil, but other fossil fuels as well. I mean, even President George W. Bush told us that we were addicted to oil and had to do something about that. Okay, so the conversation was about climate change. It was about the finite nature of these fuels. It was about how we depended so much on imports of oil. So there was some effort, at least some initial effort, into developing renewable energy and to implementing more conservation standards. Well, today, much of the momentum in that direction is gone because we've been told, even by President Obama, that we have 100 years of natural gas. So why bother, you know, working hard to develop renewable energy when we can reduce our carbon footprint just by switching to abundant gas from shale fracking operations? This has this has given us an energy policy of all of the above, which is indistinguishable from having no energy policy at all. In the best instance, this little bubble of production of shale gas and tight oil could have bought us some time to redouble our efforts to develop renewable energy and conservation. But instead of doing that, we took our foot off the accelerator altogether, and the U.S. is basically just coasting right now in terms of energy policy, and that's a tragedy that we will all be living with for decades to come.
Well, is there any way to reverse course? I mean, I think depending on what part of the United States you're in, if you're in Portland, Oregon, you think that we have a really good energy policy because at least the city and the county and the state to some degree promote much greener policies. And right. we don't have any natural gas or oil fracking, as far as I know, yet here in Oregon, nor do I think we have the resources to exploit. But if you're, of course, in North Dakota or Texas and parts of California, it's a totally different story. So how do we change the conversation back to where we were going a few years ago?
Well, I think one of the things that has to happen is we have to realize the short-term nature of this this little, you know, boomtown bonanza that's been going on, and realize that we do have a short amount of time in which to make this energy transition. We don't have decades and decades to get off of fossil fuels. We really need to do it within the next 20 years, and that's an extremely rapid transition in terms of historic energy transitions. That's much more rapid than anything that's ever taken place before. So it has to absolutely be our top priority. And hopefully the book Snake Oil will help in that change in conversation. But it has to come from many quarters. You know, one book is not going to do that. I think it's going to take a general reassessment of fracking and the potential of fracking before people realize that, you know, they've been sold a bill of goods and we really have to get back to work.
Well, some of my concern is that there's still a real tendency in, particularly in this country, but I think throughout a good part of the world, to look towards these super technologies that are going to make anything possible that we want to have possible. And I got an email today, and I wish I remembered the name of the group that's putting it out, talking about energy policies that are working, and they were really touting carbon capture.
Yes.
And sequestration. And so let's talk a little bit about some of these technologies. I mean, they were saying this works. This is a proven technology. This is going to be the most effective way of curbing greenhouse gas. So yeah. What is your answer to that?
Right. Well, it is a proven technology. I mean, there are plants up and operating that capture carbon and inject it underground, usually for the purpose of enhanced oil production, you know, injecting CO2 underground to force the oil toward the well bore so that, you know, you get more oil out of the well. But to expand carbon capture and storage to all of our coal power plants would be enormously costly. We're talking about many hundreds of billions of dollars. Not only would it raise electricity prices much higher than the cost of renewable energy, but also there would be an energy cost of about 40%. You know, it costs energy to run all of those compressors and pumps and pipelines to send the CO2 from the coal power plant to the storage facility and that energy has to come from somewhere. So it would be coming from the same power plant that the carbon's being captured from, presumably. So that's about a 40% energy penalty. So that means that you'd have to burn 40% more coal to capture the CO2 from the coal that you're burning. It's just nonsensical. It's a technology that makes no sense from an economic standpoint as well as an environmental standpoint.
Well, there's a futurist, and I'm thinking in particular Stuart Brand, who was famous for the Whole Earth Catalog, which was maybe right. The best of his futurism, who's a big tatter now of technology as a fix for climate change issues, and whether it's shooting carbon into outer space or carbon capture, or he's really a big booster of these small next generation nuclear power plants. How do we counter, whether we're talking about a futurist like Stuart Brand or the old style futurist like Herman Kahn, in terms of like looking realistically at what the future really is holding for us?
Right. Well, the futurists like to take a blank sheet of paper and just do a few numbers and solve all of our problems that way. But the real world is a lot more complicated. With nuclear energy, for example, which, as you say, Stuart Brand is a big proponent of nuclear power. But the people who actually do the numbers are not so excited about nuclear energy anymore. The Economist magazine, which nobody has accused lately of being a rabid left-wing environmental rag, The Economist magazine just a few months ago ran a cover story with a big report inside called Nuclear Energy, The Dream That Failed. And they looked at the failed investments, the immense requirement for government investment and loan guarantees. And they concluded that, especially in today's economy, nuclear power basically just has no future. We could go through the list of promising technologies, nuclear fusion, oil shale in Colorado is often mentioned as, there's this immense resource there. It could be 800 billion barrels worth of oil from this stuff that just has to be mined and turned into some kind of liquid fuel. Yes, but Shell just closed down their research station there because they couldn't figure out how to make any money doing it, even with the most advanced technology they'd been able to develop. Technology is not a substitute for energy. We have, over the past century and a half, benefited from energy that was extraordinarily cheap, abundant, and concentrated in the form of high-grade fossil fuels. That was a one-time-only bonanza from planet Earth, and we've already used the best and easiest and cheapest of the fossil fuels. From here on, it's going to be more dirty and expensive and environmentally problematic every step of the way. So there's no solution there. Nuclear, again, just too expensive, too risky, as we've seen in Fukushima. The disaster there is just spiraling out of control. Nobody knows how to contain it. So what's left? Well, renewable energy, solar and wind, and conservation, using less. These are the proven pathways to the future. It's going to be a future that looks a little different from what Stuart Brand imagines, but it's a future we can live with.
Well, I want to thank you very much for joining us, Richard. It's always great talking to you, and I look forward to your next book.
Thank you, Barbara.
Okay. We've been talking this morning with Richard Heinberg, who's author of Snake Oil, How Fracking's False Promise of Plenty Imperils Our Future, and you're listening to Locus Focus here on Cable Community Radio. If you're just tuning in and you'd like to hear what you missed or you want your friends or family to hear this show, you can listen to it online or download the audio later this afternoon on our website, kboo.fm/locusfocus. Next week, we'll talk with Mike Houck and Bob Salinger about an effort afoot to take control of Portland's Bureau of Environmental Services and Water Bureaus away from Portland City Council and transfer them to an obscure board lacking in transparency and accountability. My engineer this morning is Joe Clement. Thank you, Joe. It's good to have you on board. I'm Barbara Bernstein. We're going to go out with some music by Joni Mitchell. Thanks for listening. Sex.
sells everything.
Tune in to Talking Earth, a show dedicated to showcasing our local poetry scene. Join hosts Patrick Picard, Barbara LaMorticella, and Walt Curtis for Talking Earth on the second and third Mondays of each month from 10 to 11 p.m. More information can be found on kboo.fm under schedule.
You are tuned to KBOO 90.7 FM in Portland. The time is just about 11 o'clock. Up next, on Health and Healthcare Forum, host Roberta Hall speaks with chiropractor lobbyist Vern Sabo about recent progress in expanding public health care reform to offer what has been called alternative care.
Welcome to the Health and Healthcare Forum. I'm Roberta Hall. Our series on health and healthcare features conversations about diverse health concerns. I enjoy these conversations, and I hope you do too. Well, my guest today is someone who's been on the program before. Vern Sabo is a chiropractor. His workplace is in Albany, but he also speaks on behalf of chiropractors in the legislature. He's a lobbyist there, and so that's a part-time occupation, but he's gotten very interested in following the legislation and influencing it. But then there's the problem of enforcement, which is another whole issue in itself. So welcome, Vern.
Thank you.
Let's start out with some new developments and then go into some background after that, and new developments relating to whether in the transformation process of our healthcare system, whether chiropractors, naturopaths, and other so-called alternative or complementary practitioners are part of the system.